time for This Week in Chicago History with Anna DeVlantis. Anna, good morning.
Morning, Bob.
Start with a little gangster history today, don't we?
This was the week, Bob, one for the history books. 1929, the most infamous of all mob slayings in America, taking place inside a Northside garage, 2122 North Clark Street. The St. Valentine's Day Massacre. Seven men lined up, systematically gunned down in machine gun fire by a crew dressed as police officers. The gruesome crime was immediately connected to Al Capone, even though he had the airtight alibi. He was at his vacation home in Florida, but it was widely believed that he was behind it. Capone was fighting for control of the bootlegging operations. He was the South Side King. He was taking out the North Side crew, Bugs Moran's crew, and so that's what he needed to do. But this was a time, and I went back and looked at the newspaper headlines, and it was a time when mob crimes dominated the headlines quite a bit. But the St. Valentine's Day Massacre left the city, it just shook the city to its core. A line had been crossed, and there was a Tribune editorial at the time that said, these murders are out of comprehension for a civilized city. And that became a call to action, Bob, at that time. Al Capone was now public enemy number one. Politicians, the police, the public, the feds, all focused on stopping him at any cost. We pulled a clip here from WTTW, a documentary they did covering the mood of the city at that time.
Good to hear John Calloway again. That building is gone, isn't it? I've gone to that alley. There's a little sign there, isn't there?
You and the tour bus, Bob. I think there's a tour bus that might go by there for the mobster gangster tours. But you know, it took several years, several decades, in fact, three decades, where it still stood there as a garage. It was an operational auto garage. But then the local neighborhood organizations and the Lincoln Park Project decided that it wasn't something they wanted to preserve. And so it was mowed down. And now it's a parking lot they have right next to a senior center. So it's kind of that combo, but no longer a garage like it was way back then.
Yeah, right next to the Biograph Theater, 2122 North Clark Street. Let's talk about what many point to as the evening that Michael Jordan became an NBA star.
Yeah, you think back to this, and I know some of your listeners will have personal memories of this, Bob, because I know it made quite an impact at the time, but some say this was the moment that Michael Jordan became an NBA superstar. It was All-Star Weekend. It was being held in his hometown of Chicago, February 6, 1988. Jordan, in his fourth season in the NBA at that time, he had yet to win a championship, but he was making his ascent as a player, and he arrived at All-Star Weekend, the most talked-about player in the NBA. He left fans everywhere in awe, dominating every event he entered, winning the slam dunk contest, one of the greatest of all time, scoring 40 points in the All-Star game, earning the MVP title. And we pulled a clip of WGN-TV's coverage of the All-Star game back in 88, the slam dunk contest, Jordan versus Dominique Wilkins, and a clip from Jordan explaining how a tip from legendary basketball player Dr. J is what helped put him over the top in the slam dunk contest.
The veterans took notice, didn't they?
They did. It was interesting because also in that WGN coverage, Bob, they interviewed Larry Bird and Isaiah Thomas, and they're like, what just happened? Like, this guy, this Jordan guy, they were saying this is his weekend. You know, they were obviously complimentary, but they were also kind of like, this was his day. He just dominated. And 3 years later, of course, Jordan went on to win his first Bulls NBA championship, and the rest is history.
And now we remember the Bears Super Bowl that people forget about, except for Devin Hester, right?
Except for Devin Hester, the one memory. You know, we're kind of in this wait until next year mode, I think, with Bears fans, and we're used to that as Cubs fans, but this is the one memory that we can all cling to, the legendary Devin Hester this week, Super Bowl 41, 19 years ago, with the Bears versus the Colts, and Hester returning the opening kickoff, running it back 92 yards for a touchdown, and he did it, Bob, in a remarkable 14 seconds, setting an NFL record, remaining today the only time in Super Bowl history that that has happened, that an opening kickoff was returned for a score. We can just remember, some of us, exactly where we were when it happened, but we pulled the clip to look back at that day. All Bears fans remember.
Jim Nance with that call. It was downhill after that, though, wasn't it?
It was so so miserable, wasn't it? I remember being at that game, and we were just so fired up. This was amazing. But I think the only thing that I remember from that is Devin Hester and that play, the fact that the Bears won the coin toss, and then Prince at halftime. That was
the highlight for Chicago fans. We have more This Week in Chicago History with Anna DeVlantis coming up. It was a rockin' star-studded auto show in Chicago this week in 1986. Anna?
That's right, Bob. You know, it's interesting because there's some major celebrities living in Chicago getting global attention right about that time. And for some reason, they all were at the Chicago Auto Show 1986, this week in 86. And it was incredibly star-studded. You had Walter Payton, who was fresh off the Super Bowl championship Bears team win. You know, he was out at Buick signing autographs. You had Jay Helgenberg, Jim Covert, Tom Thayer, and Keith Van Horn. They were at Chevrolet. The Refrigerator Perry was at Pontiac. It was the 100th anniversary of the automobile, and they literally pulled out all the stops. In addition to the Bears, if you went to the Chicago Auto Show that year, you'd also run into Michael Jordan shaking hands outside Chevy, and Ryan Sandberg was there, too. And then a few exhibits over, you'd find none other than Oprah Winfrey, who was promoting her talk show and The Color Purple, which had just been come out in like a couple months before in December. So funny that given all that context that the ads in the Tribune at the time were reading the cars are the stars, but they were promoting lots and lots of big names that were there at what they said was the biggest and greatest auto show in the world. Kind of interesting to think of that many people, that many celebrities in one spot.
Yeah, who wasn't there for that? That was a big one. The heart-shaped pizza is around at a lot of places now, but Malnati's was first, weren't they?
Yeah, they were the first ones, Bob. 1973, Lou Malnati himself launched the heart-shaped pizzas at the original restaurant, his original restaurant in Lincolnwood. Started by Lou himself, a Chicago guy who learned the ropes in top pizza kitchens across the city, and then opened his own. It was his chance to venture out on his own at the Lincolnwood location that he opened. And he was concerned that people weren't going to come to a pizza place for Valentine's Day. So he's like, well, let me do this. He set up the white tablecloths. He got the candlelight kind of mood going. And then he created these heart-shaped deep dish pizzas, which people just loved. You know, it just took off and has existed pretty much ever since. Promotions like that helped that first location really become successful. He was kind of a genius marketer. And so we pulled a clip here that I think you'll appreciate, Bob. Jean Malnati, Lou's wife, talking about how her husband went to his dad originally and said, you know, Dad, I'm going to open up a pizzeria in Lincolnwood. And his dad basically tried to talk him out of it, saying, you're nuts. It'll never work.
Yeah, the north suburbs weren't exactly what they are now back then in 71,
no.
Huh?
No, not booming at that time. But Elwood's also started out there, too, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah, now it's busy. Lots of restaurants in the area. Well, yeah. nothing says love like pepperoni. Finally, we have the story of a Chicago invention that I don't think anybody's ever heard about this. Tell us, Anna.
No. I filed this into the Hey, Did You Know file because didn't know this myself, Bob, but the porta potty has its roots in Chicago, the modern porta potty, the invention of two Chicago guys. Not a glamorous business, but I think one we all can remember a time when we were really, really, really thankful to see one. Great backstory. Founder Ed Cooper was working on the back of a garbage truck, had a small trash collection business. When he saw that his industry was consolidating and he was looking for a new business to get into, so teams up with his brother-in-law, Ed Hisks. They buy two portable toilets and a broken-down truck from a guy in Indiana, and from that launched a successful national porta-potty business. These are the bright blue plastic porta-johns that were the originals, you could say, in the plastic category. Before that, portable toilets were mostly wood or fiberglass, and the fiberglass couldn't be easily moved to like concert venues and couldn't move them around a lot. But the wood ones were absorbing the odor, so that's not good either. They changed the product and really changed the industry. And now, what do you know? We're all very thankful when we see one of those porta potties at the, you know, neighborhood festivals, at concerts, and, you know, outside construction zones. Anywhere you go, sometimes you just need the porta john. And thankful for these two Chicagoans and their invention.
Mm-hmm. Anywhere, cool. Anywhere you go, no pun intended. What did we do before 1982? Hey, let's change the signs outside of O'Hare. Welcome to Chicago. Home of the porta potty.
Right? Why not? Let's start bragging about this stuff, Bob. Come on.
Thank you, Anna. We'll talk to you next week.